time for the news read by Danielle Yawowiecka.
Ukraine says 10 people are now known to have died after its energy infrastructure was attacked with more than 200 Russian drones and missiles. President Zelensky said about two-thirds of them had been destroyed, but that power had been cut in many areas. Ukrainian officials fear it could signal another concerted Russian attempt to deplete the power grid as winter arrives. The Hamas-run civil defence agency in Gaza says at least 46 people have been killed and nearly 60 are missing after a series of Israeli airstrikes. Officials said a refugee camp in central Gaza and a residential building in the north were targeted. Israel says it's trying to prevent Hamas fighters from regrouping. The leader of the Liberal Democrats has hinted that the head of his party in Wales should resign over her handling of a sexual abuse case when she worked for the Church of England. A 2021 report has found that Jane Dodds made a grave error by not organising a meeting to discuss a particular case. She says she accepts there were shortcomings. Sir Ed Davey said she needed to reflect on this very carefully and think about what else she may need to do. His remarks follow the resignation of the Archbishop of Canterbury last week for failures in the way he handled a child abuse scandal. The Transport Secretary Louise Hague has defended the incoming increase in the cap of a single bus fare, which is due to rise from £2 to £3. She said it could have gone up much further without government intervention. It's part of changes to bus services, which will include investing £1 billion to deliver a London-style system nationwide that Ms Hague says will increase reliability and frequency. A super typhoon that's been sweeping across the Philippines has made landfall on the main island of Luzon. Forecasters are warning that it poses a risk to life with fears of flash floods and landslides. More than a million people have fled their homes. And a gold pocket watch given to the captain of a ship which rescued 700 people from the Titanic has sold at auction to a private collector in the US for more than £1.5 million. A look at the weather. Cloudy for many this afternoon with patchy rain in Northern Ireland, Wales and England. Bright spells and drier in southeast England. And that's the BBC News and weather at 2 minutes past 12. Now here on BBC Radio 3, it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Rupert Everett left school at 16 to train as an actor and first shot to global fame in 1984 as a dashing public schoolboy in the film Another Country. Since then, his career has been defiantly unpredictable. He starred in Hollywood films, taken leading roles on stage in the West End and Broadway, and directed, written and played the lead in a passion project about Oscar Wilde's final years. He's made documentaries and written three candid, irreverent and very funny memoirs. Most recently, he's turned to short stories with a wonderful collection called The American No, which includes deathbed confessions, Hare Krishna monks in Soho and a drug-fueled funeral in Paris. Well, Rupert, you've brought us a wonderful collection of music today, Ravel, Purcell, Beethoven, but Handel to begin.
Handel is one of my favourite composers, and the Messiah I sang in when I was at school, first of all as a treble, and then I played in the orchestra at school as a second violin. And I think of all Christmas music, this particular song, I Know That My Redeemer Liveth, is one of the most magical. It's so tender and beautiful and sad, and it seems to have a kind of premonitionary feeling about the tragedy of Christ as well as the Nativity, and I love it very much.
Thank you.
It's more romantic in a way than a lot of romantic music, I find.
And that was a particularly yearning, gentle, lilting performance, wasn't it?
Very, very sad performance. It's a lovely, lovely song. And, gosh, I couldn't believe it, actually, just listening to it then.
I Know That My Redeemer Liveth, from Handel's Messiah, performed by Carolyn Sampson and the 16 Orchestra, conducted by Harry Christophers. Tell us a little bit about your early life, Rupert. You had a rural upbringing in Essex.
A rural upbringing in Essex, boarding school in Hampshire and then Yorkshire, educated by monks, or not educated by monks, rather. And then I left school when I was about 16 and came to London and went to drama school.
Your father had been a major in the army, hadn't he?
That's right.
Did a degree of stiff upper lip translate into your life?
It certainly did, in a strange way. I think the fact that I survived the battering I gave myself, really, from the age of 16 till 30-ish, was to do with having a kind of very serious and tough work ethic instilled into me. I never could go quite the whole hog in destroying myself.
But you were close to your mother, weren't you?
I was close to my mother, and then by the end of his life, I was close to my father too.
And your mother's still alive?
My mother's still alive. We live together in the country, and we're still friends.
That's a rather wonderful achievement, I think.
Well, in one sense it is, and in one sense it feels a little bit like you always hope you're going to go somewhere and never come back. But I suppose the reality is in life that you're always washed back up on the shores of your upbringing.
One of your most formative experiences when you were young was going to the cinema when you were about six?
To see Mary Poppins. And in a way, I think my emotional development froze at that point. It's difficult to describe to younger people what it was like going into a big provincial flea pit in the 60s. You know, the cinemas were gigantic. The curtains were these kind of crimson silk affairs lit from underneath. Terribly exciting. There was a kind of whiff of sex and cigarette smoke and carbolic in the air that at age six you didn't quite understand, but you had a feeling for it. Solitary men sitting at the back smoking, couples snogging, and me and my mum. And the film seemed to come out from the screen as opposed to being projected onto it, and the curtains drew back. And seeing Julie Andrews and David Tomlinson and Dick Van Dyke and Glynis Johns, Michelle Dautrice, lots of characters in it. I still enjoy that film enormously. It's a wonderfully made film.
And it prompted you as a child to start experimenting with clothes, dressing up, imagining up being in another life?
Yes, it started me off. I decided that Julie Andrews was my mother. I was her daughter. And I'd just been dumped on this rather tiresome and common military family. And I told everyone at school that this was what had happened, and they all believed me. And it's how I ended up in my first child psychiatrist, as a matter of fact. My parents, at a certain point, couldn't think what to do with me and took me to a doctor in Harley Street. I was left to play with a rabbit. And my mother was taken next door to talk to the psychiatrist. And then she came storming in about 3 minutes later, said, "We're going." And years later, I discovered it was because the psychiatrist had asked her about her sex life. And she found that incredibly impertinent. And that was the end of my world of psychiatry.
So the next piece of music, it's a slow movement from a concerto, which looks back to a previous age.
It's the Adagio from Ravel's Concerto for Piano and Orchestra. And I discovered it through my great friend Philip Prowse, who directed me in a production of Noel Coward's The Vortex. And the character I played was a kind of failed, drug-addicted concert pianist. And Philip chose, for the only moment that he played the piano, the very weird, discordant moment in the middle of this movement. And I didn't discover the rest of the movement till a bit later, but really, this is one of the most romantic pieces of music. Thank you.
We both looked at each other, Rupert Everett, at the moment when the piano suddenly comes in the wrong key, as it were.
Mm.
And it does sound a discordant but very satisfying moment.
It's very satisfying. It's an amazing bit of music and a wonderful recording with the BBC Symphony Orchestra.
Yes, it's the Adagio from Ravel's Concerto for Piano and Orchestra in G Major, performed by Jean-Yves Lambavouzé and the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jan-Pascal Tortelier. Music was quite a refuge for you, I think, when you were young, and you were taught the clarinet.
I was taught the clarinet, I was taught the violin, I was taught the piano. I spent my whole school days, until I discovered acting, playing. And the music room at school was a great refuge, and so was the little practice rooms with the pianos. You could do anything in them, really. A great escape from a very hearty rugby and football-obsessed
establishment. Did you, like me, play the organ?
I did play the organ, yes. And my first school, I played the organ for all the services. I just learned how to play Over the Rainbow. And when everyone was going to communion, I launched into Over the Rainbow one day at school. And I always remember the teachers' faces looking horrified.
You actually went to a Catholic secondary school, Amplethorpe College in Yorkshire. And I think it's there that you really got the acting bug.
Yes, I started off really more into music there too. For the first 2 years, I was in the choir and taking my piano lessons pretty seriously. But then, the end of my first year, I started acting. I got to play all the girls' parts in the plays, which I adored. And I made a little kind of group of friends in the acting world. And actually, one of them, an actor called Julian Wadham, we left Amberforth together. We went to drama school together. And we were in our first West End show together. And we've worked together really all through our careers, which has been very satisfying.
So would it have been Shakespeare at school?
Well, I was Titania in Midsummer Night's Dream. I was Elvira in Blithe Spirit. And then my swan song was as Mary Stuart in Schiller's Mary Stuart. I think that was my greatest performance.
Did you enjoy doing the female roles, or would you have quite liked to have done some of the male roles?
No, I would have hated to do the male roles. I loved the girls' roles, and I used to spend the whole holidays sorting out my costumes. And for Mary Stuart, I remember making my mum take me to Stratford-on-Avon, where there was a costume hire. And in the underwear shop in Braintree, there was a very nice nightdress for sale, and I made my mother queue from 6:30 in the morning to get it, and then I dyed it grey to be ghost-like. So I was very into being a girl.
Had they come to terms a little bit with who you were by now, your parents?
They didn't seem very interested, to be quite honest. They just let me get on with things. My mother had discarded a red tweed skirt that I took for myself, and that was really when my fantasy about being Julie Andrews' daughter really kind of took off. And I wore it most of the time. They didn't seem that bothered by it, really, which is, I think, quite a sensible attitude.
So, tweed skirt and the rabbit, you got by.
Mm.
We're going to hear next music by Wagner. And I wonder what made you home in on this.
Well, this year I was contracted to take part in a film about Wagner's death in Venice. And even though Wagner was 5'2" and I'm 6'5", I quite often get these parts of little people and I have to try and psychologically turn myself into a little person. Unfortunately, we arrived and the film collapsed. But I find Wagner quite difficult in a way, but the overtures of everything I love, and the overture to Parsifal I actually put also in my film about Oscar Wilde, and I find it one of the most extraordinary pieces of music. Very, very weird and ghostly and extraordinary.
Well, Mark Elder, who's conducting here, did a wonderful production of Parsifal when he was at ENO. And I didn't think I liked Parsifal, but I ended up in tears at the end.
Really?
I love it when that happens.
I ended up with piles at the end of The Meistersinger because I went to see it in Bayreuth. And, I mean, I've never been more excruciated in my entire life, honestly. I couldn't believe it. It just went on and on and on. And the seats...
Tears of pain.
Tears of pain.
Well, we've never had that reaction to Wagner on Private Passions before. We'll bear that in mind as we listen to the overture.
Thank you.
I can't imagine how Wagner the man came up with that, because the more I discovered about him researching the job I was going to do, I felt rather relieved in the end that it had collapsed, because he seemed to me such an unpleasant little person, really, with such an overblown ego and a horrible wife, and everything about him seemed unappealing, actually. But then suddenly you hear that, and it's so... I mean, talk about a wall of sound. It's so moving.
But there's nothing to say, is there, Rupert, that you have to be a nice person in order to write great things or to achieve great art. I mean, it just is sometimes the case that...
I know, but you have to somehow be someone who's capable of those feelings. I think young him must have been very appealing. But by the time he'd ended up in Venice, he was a pretty unappealing person, I think.
We heard the prelude from Parsifal by Wagner, performed by the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Mark Elder. Of course, Parsifal is all about Amfortas and this awful wound that he has to bear. Your wound was perhaps more prosaic, but no less painful, sitting on hard seats at Bayreuth. In 1975, you were living in London, and a whole new world opened up to you. You discovered a pub, the Cold Hern. What was this like to suddenly find all this as a young man?
Well, I wasn't even a young man, really. I was only, I think, 17 years old. I was renting a bedroom in a house off the Fulham Road, and the owners had two dogs called Samson and Biscuit, and they let me take the dogs for a walk in the evening, and I was walking Samson and Biscuit up the Redcliffe Road, and this apparition appeared before me, this big, tall man in black leather with a black leather hat, and all three of us were absolutely overwhelmed with excitement, and we followed him. And he turned left into Old Brompton Road and disappeared into this pub, the Cold Hern. And me and Samson and Biscuit looked through the windows, and there were all these cowboys and leather queens and fairies and skinheads, and we couldn't believe it. So I rushed Samson and Biscuit back home.
Because they shouldn't be exposed to this.
They couldn't. They were too shocked. And then I came back, and that started a new kind of chapter in my life, the chapter as a leather queen, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Homosexuality had been legalised, but the law was still quite ambiguous at the time, wasn't it?
Yes, and I mean, I remember going there. I used to circle, go around the block about five times before going in, just to make sure that nobody who knew my family or anyone I knew was around about. But once you did get in, you really counted just for being there. And it was an extraordinary world, the gay scene in those days, because it was classless, ageless, and raceless, really. It was such a small scene. Very old people were there, very young people were there. A duke in full leather would be chatting with a plumber and then probably would get beaten up by him very satisfactorily later on. And it was an amazing melting pot. It was a wonderful Midsummer Night's Dream world. Mm.
You were very candid in your autobiography, even about how you made money in those days. I mean, was it a form of rebellion, do you think?
I think I came from such a... It used to be called the upper middle classes. They've kind of disappeared now, but they were very strict, and they were brought up on rationing and the Blitz and the end of the war and the fury at the end of Empire. It felt like you couldn't really get away from it, that you were funneled into something like either the Stock Exchange or, if you were lucky, Sotheby's, but probably not. And it just felt that was the only way to break it up, having a kind of sexual revolution of my own. It felt like it was a huge liberating step. Actually, it ended up being, you know, jumping into another type of prison in a way, because when you become a sexual obsessive, it ends up being just as constricting as what you were trying to get away from, in a way.
That's fascinating, isn't it, that liberation can be so confining.
Yes, I mean, interesting.
Then you got into drama school.
Then I got into drama school. Mm. I found drama school a little bit disappointing too, because having escaped this military background, in fact, the world of show business is equally militaristic. It's all about arriving on time. And I'd expected it all to be kind of cross-dressing and drug-taking and sex with everybody. And it really wasn't that. It was also quite middle class. And I didn't last very long at my drama school, only 2 years. But then I did get to a theatre company in Scotland called the Glasgow Citizens Company.
That was a very good one.
It was a wonderful company. And there really everything that I hoped would happen did happen. Mm. Meeting the people, Philip Prowse, David MacDonald and Giles Havergal, who ran that company, that was a very decisive moment for me and the beginning of an education. And any kind of aesthetic sense that I have, such as it is, I kind of gleaned from being there, really.
Another country which was your great break in many ways, but it started as a play.
It did. I'd been in Glasgow for a little while and I got the audition for another country. I got the part. It was at the Greenwich Theatre initially. Then it went into the West End and then we made the film of it. So it was one of those eras in my life where it was kind of green lights all the way.
You've chosen some film music next.
Oh, yes. The next thing I've chosen is because I recently worked for Ridley Scott in Napoleon, and I loved working for him, partly because he's rather like Elton John. He's a kind of unquestionable hero in my mind. And seeing Blade Runner the first time was a great event for me, too. And I think Vangelis, who did three or four really incredible film scores. And
Chariots of Fire.
Chariots of Fire. Mm. But this one is incredible, simple, so deep and frightening. Thank you.
the love theme from Vangelis's score for Blade Runner. Rupert Everett, Orson Welles saw another country. He got your number and he called you up.
He did. I was sitting at home with Simon Callow at the time, and he called me up every day for a while. And when the phone rang, I said to Simon Callow, "Oh, that'll be Orson Welles calling." And he said,
"As one does."
As one does. And he couldn't believe, because I was very nervous, in fact. So I said, "Yes, Orson. OK, fine. OK, see you later. Bye." And he said, "That was Orson Welles." And it was the beginning of a not very successful relationship, because he flew me out to Los Angeles. And I think as soon as he saw me, he was very disappointed.
What do you think he had in mind for you?
Oh, I was going to play him. In this film, The Cradle Will Rock. And he'd seen me in another country, so he knew what I was like. But I couldn't measure up to him. I was stick insect thin. My voice hadn't really broken. You know, the reality, I think, was different. And I think I was a disappointment to him.
But then, to make up for that disappointment, a wonderful phone call regarding the person you worshipped, in fact.
Oh, yes. Well, that was a little bit later. The most wonderful end to my childhood fantasy of being Julie Andrews' daughter came along in the form of the film Duet for One. Originally a play about the cellist Jacqueline Dupré, turned for the movie's purposes into a violinist, and Julie Andrews was playing the lead role, and I got the part of her protégé, and I was to show up at the Dorchester Hotel for a month of violin classes with Julie Andrews. Well, I just couldn't believe, I had to pinch myself, I was so excited. And the great thing was, I already played the violin, but I pretended that I didn't, because I was very keen to impress Julie and to show her how innately, animalistically musical I was. And so I arrived at the Oliver Messel suite in the Dorchester, and there she was. We had our violins, and she said, "Gosh, you're good." And I said, "Well, I don't know." I just said, and she found it very difficult. The violin is very difficult. So she was immediately impressed. "Are you a real musician?" she said to me. And I was absolutely enamoured by her. She wasn't enamoured by me. I decided to base my character on Nigel Kennedy, who was just starting out then, and he was a kind of breath of fresh air in terms of how musicians behaved. And I remember borrowing a leather jacket from Adamant, and Julie was not very happy with the way I had got myself up, and she complained a little bit at first to the director. But he was an amazing guy, Andrei Konchalovsky, a Russian director, and I was allowed to go on with my performance. And eventually I told Julie about my childhood fantasies and how I'd ended up going to the child psychiatrist with the rabbit because I was her daughter. And at first she was a little shocked, but then she kind of came round to the idea. And then we've worked together quite a few times since then, and she sent me a little card saying, "Love from Mummy." The last time I saw her, I was in Blithe Spirit on Broadway with Angela Lansbury. I was on stage one afternoon, and Angela Lansbury whispered to me during the show, "Mummy's in the audience." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Mummy's in the audience. Come to my dressing room after the show." And there was Julie. And I've got the greatest picture of me and Angela and Julie together. Julie Andrews is a goddess in my mind. When Julie Andrews goes, I'm going.
You had to play the violin in a scene filmed at the Albert Hall, didn't you?
Yes. The most amazing part of it was that they filled the whole Albert Hall with people. And I had to go and knock on the door of dressing room one. She'd come out and I said, "Darling, are you ready?" And she said, "Yes, don't be nervous." And we walked. I don't know if you've been in the bowels of the Albert Hall, but there are these huge ramps up towards the orchestra pit. And we walked up, cameras following us, lights, everything. I mean, it was like, I couldn't believe that my life had ended up in such a perfect kind of realisation of
the
a
last
childhood.
Night of the proms.
It was. And anyway, we got onto the stage. The audience stood up as one. The conductor arrived, tick, 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 tick. And we launched into the Bach Double Violin Concerto. And all my friends, all my Julie Andrews fans' friends were looking at me from the front row because they'd all got tickets, green with envy. And I didn't talk to any of them and just kind of sat chatting with Julie in the moments between takes. And it was one of the best moments of realising one's dreams that I had. The other one, which was very good also, is when I was a dresser, when I was at drama school, I was Alan Howard's dresser. He was doing Coriolanus. And he had these amazing leather costumes. And of course, being a young leather queen, I was eyeing these costumes very greedily. And one night, there was a, I think it was Tuesday night, so there was a club called Bang. And I thought, I'm going to take this leather costume and wear it, and I'm going to have a huge success. So I took the leather costume out in a bag, put it on, and then forgot it at home the next day. And when we got to Act Two to put on the costume there, it wasn't. And I was too guileless in those days to think up a decent excuse. So I told them I took it to this leather club. And then I got fired from the RSC. But 40 years later, we were making Parade's End, a Ford Madox Ford book that Tom Stoppard adapted into a series. And I was his son. And he had lost his leg, and actually it was the last job he did. And that also was an amazing finish to a story.
Well, let's hear some of the Bach. This is the first movement. It's perfect.
Having acid flashbacks here, yes. And we had to have, because neither of us could really handle the vibrato very convincingly, so we would have kind of two people behind us, one doing the vibrato and one bowing, and we'd have our arms behind our backs.
Almost tied.
Yes, more or less. But it's quite effective the way they do
amazing
violin playing in the movies, because you really can't tell.
Yeah. We heard the first movement of Bach's Concerto for Two Violins and String Orchestra in D minor, performed by Petra Muljan and Gottfried von der Goltz. and the Freiburg Baroque Orchestra. Rupert Everett, you have said that in some ways you regret that you came out.
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
No.
You didn't feel that it affected your opportunities?
No, I did, but I never said I regretted it. I mean, it wasn't really a question of... I didn't have a choice, particularly. I lived a certain type of life, unless I was going to live very dangerously. There was no point in lying about it. I enjoyed going out, so it wasn't like I had a choice about living in the closet or something like that. I've always been quoted as saying I regretted it, but I didn't say that. I think when there's things that you're certain about in your life, it's not really a question of choice. You just do it.
You began writing a novel, Hello, Darling, Are You Working?, a farce about an actor down on his luck. Was that one way of dealing with what was happening in terms of work?
To be honest, I wasn't thinking very precisely about anything. I was just kind of living from moment to moment like a pinball. Just kind of got on with things.
You wrote very touchingly, too, about the AIDS crisis and how that was affecting you and those very close to you at the time.
It was a kind of character-splitting thing in my life, because on the one hand I was in front of the camera, and on the other hand I was living in terror of getting sick, because everybody was. No one quite knew what the whole situation was. There was no way of testing for HIV until, I think, 1988 or something. So the first few years you were in a limbo, rather like a kind of cartoon character who'd run over the edge of a cliff. So I think being in front of the camera, which was on the one side obviously very edifying and exciting, was also a great fear, because I was always thinking, God, maybe one day someone's going to come up to me saying, what's that spot on your head? And then the game would be up in a very frightening way. You know, I think people don't really remember what it was like when AIDS hit, but, you know, you'd go to Sunday lunch with a family and you'd see your plates being taken gingerly away to wash up separately from the others, which was fine. But, you know, you realise that everybody else was quite frightened of you, and you were obviously frightened too, because a lot of people you knew were already suffering with it. So it was a very difficult and scary time.
And you must have lost quite a few good friends.
A lot of people. I knew a lot of people who got AIDS too. And funnily enough, a few weeks ago I was doing a show at the Wilton's Music Hall about Tom Gunn, who is a poet who wrote wonderful poetry about AIDS, and his whole world literally collapsed. It was a very, very, very bleak and terrifying time.
Well, then, on a happy note, you got huge success in 1997 when you starred in My Best Friend's Wedding with Julia Roberts, received a Golden Globe Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor, cast as her gay best friend. Was that a happy experience for you?
It was a wonderful experience, and it launched my next career as a kind of the gay best friend. And it was amazing. I made great friends on it with the director, P.J. Hogan, and the filming itself was great. It was another period in my life where it was kind of green lights all the way. For a while, I lived in Hollywood and lived the dream, in a way.
Well, the next piece is a wonderful piece by Beethoven, an adagio from the Ninth Symphony.
Yes, and this was another piece of music that I discovered through Philip Prowse. The first show I ever did was an adaptation of the complete works of Proust, and he used the beginning of this movement, played by a piano, as the theme of the composer Van Teuil, the composer that everyone loves back in the day in Proust, and who ends up being an old doddery homophobe in Cambrai at the end. And it was a wonderful piece of music to use, because it was played on a piano at first, and then at the moment where Swan is putting the cattleya onto Odette, it suddenly came up in its full orchestral form.
Like going musically from black and white into colour.
Yeah, exactly.
part of the Adagio from Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 in D minor, performed by the NDR Orchestra, conducted by Günter Wand. Rupert Everett, Oscar Wilde has been a lifelong obsession for you. I mean, his life, it's such an extraordinary mix of triumph and tragedy, isn't it?
Yes, and godliness and humanity and cleverness and sheer stupidity and snobbery and generosity. A real human being, you know, he's very flawed. He's a madly silly fairy in some respects and a great tragic figure.
Every time I go on the Great Western Railway, I'd get a glimpse of Reading Jail and I could never stop but think sadly about that awful incarceration.
I know, me too, until I took my mother there, because Reading Jail's been turned into a hotel. And my mother went into Oscar Wilde's cell and said, "My God, this is bigger than most people's flats nowadays."
And then, of course, he had a final moment in Paris.
Yes, I love the end of his life. In the Elman biography, Elman had got pretty ill by the time he got to the end of the book, so he left it as a very small chapter. But I remember reading that and thinking, this is the part of the story that I love. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason was because Oscar in Paris is a very important person if you're gay, because I think there is where the road to gay liberation started, because finally there was a face to homosexuality. There hadn't been one before because it was all undercover. It was never spoken about. No women definitely ever spoke about it. But once you saw Oscar waddling down the boulevard and he was famous, you could say that is Ecce Homo, there's a homosexual.
And of course you played Oscar in David Hare's play, The Judas Kiss.
I did, and that was a wonderful experience too. It's a brilliant play.
You were nominated for an Olivier Award, and indeed you underwent a transformation virtually every night.
I did. I had a wonderful fat suit. I always thought that Oscar Wilde was very well endowed, so I had in the fat suit included this, a wonderful long penis and two low-hanging balls which were filled with dried peas, and they were squashed into my trousers. And seated at the front of the stage, I could see people in the front of the audience going, "My God, Rupert is well endowed." And so I had to take it down a few sizes because it was kind of taking over.
Take out a few peas. And in 2013, the Marriage Act was passed, which legalised same-sex marriage. And curiously enough, you were walking onto the stage to play Oscar that night, weren't you?
Yes, and that was, one of the great things about theatre is when you manage to have a communion with the audience. It doesn't happen every night. It happens, you know, quite often at the beginning and when you're particularly nervous. But that night, it was on the covers of all the evening papers and everybody going to the theatre, I think, that night had the same thought that, you know, this was the play to go and see.
In the past, you've said you don't like weddings, hate them, in fact, but you did marry your Brazilian partner, Henrique, earlier this year. Was that for romantic or practical reasons?
Well, we'd been together for about 15 years, and I am quite old, so you have to kind of put your house in order a little bit. And I think if you go to hospital, you need to be married as a gay man to have the other person be able to deal with things with the doctors, and then also then there's death. And
but it is romantic, I suppose, to know you want all these things. I mean, I suppose that is a romantic act in a way.
I think it's yes, it is romantic. I think it's marriage. I don't know. It's never been my greatest thing, but I think at this stage in life, and you know, I'm hoping we'll stay together, and being legally together definitely helps.
Das Lied von der Erde by Mahler next. Wonderful
Kathleen
piece.
Ferry.
I mean, which does sort of take us slightly into the next world.
Yes, and she's such a great heroine character, and listening to her is still thrilling. This particular, you know, you do feel like you're in the room with this recording for some reason.
Oh,
Of Beauty, Part 4 of Das Lied von der Erde, The Song of the Earth, by Gustav Mahler, sung by Kathleen Ferrier, with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Bruno Walter. Rupert, the latest book, The American No, which I really love, is a short story collection, but it in many ways is ideas for films which escaped you. Just explain what you mean by The American No.
The American No is when you go for a meeting to pitch your idea. It seems like it's gone very well. You leave the meeting, everyone's very happy. They say you're the perfect fit, we really want to work with you. You leave thinking it's in the bag, and then you never hear another word. And that is called the American No.
And you've experienced it one or two times.
Yeah, quite a few times.
And there's a wonderful but very moving story called The £10 Pom, about a man called Tom heading to Australia. And it's a love affair, and it ends rather awfully.
Yes, it abruptly ends with peritonitis, one of my great fears, getting peritonitis on a trip somewhere. And the whole idea of 10-pound pumps I find very romantic. All those old steamers from the pre-war eras used to transport people for only 10 pounds to Australia. And the boats would go via Lisbon, Naples, Greece, Suez. And the Greek girls, I read the story once, and this is what inspired the idea. The Greek girls used to get married in little churches in Greece, but without a husband. The husband would already be contracted to marriage, but not there. He'd be in Australia, and then she'd be taken down to the port and put on the boat. And so this story is a kind of love story between a Greek girl who's got married but doesn't know her husband and this kind of Anglo-Irish boy who's trying to make a new start.
Rupert, you make it clear in The American No and your memoirs that you really do need a rather thick skin when it comes to being an actor, and especially in the business of making films. Do you think that's always been the case, or is it much more so now?
Keane said, theatre is not for those who bleed easily. And it's not. You know, you deal with a lot of things. People's rejecting you. Success is difficult. Failure is difficult. I think it is a difficult career. And you have to have a thick hide. Mm. Then it becomes a good game. And it doesn't get particularly easier. I think it gets harder, actually, particularly as you cross over the yardarm and get old. There's thousands of us OAPs scrabbling, elbowing each other out of the way for the two or three decent roles for an octogenarian. But I'm now taking a leaf out of the Shirley MacLaine playbook, which is she, at the age of 50, decided instead of trying to be younger, she decided to play older. That's what I want to do too, because I want to play 90-year-olds, and at least I can remember the lines.
Is there a role you'd love to do, or somebody you've always wanted to get your tentacles into?
Well, it's difficult in cinema or television to think of those roles, although actually there is one. They're making a series of Harry Potter, and I think I would be a wonderful Dumbledore. But I'd like to also be King Lear. I'd like to also be Malvolio. I'd really like to get into Shakespeare. Nowadays, our language feels like it's on the edge of extinction, in a way. It's an amazing language, and it's full of nuance and incredible things. And I think maybe I should try, in my next chapter, attempt Shakespeare.
Well, enough things there to keep you out of mischief for a while. But when you get to the end of that road, perhaps you'll be thinking of your last piece of music.
This piece of music I first heard at the funeral of a lady called Isabella Blow. She was buried at Gloucester Cathedral, and her coffin was taken down the aisle of the cathedral and put into the chancel, and on top of it was a hat made by Philip Treacy, and it was of a death ship. It had sails and these amazing kind of tentacles, and there was some kind of underground heating system that came up through grills, and as we were sitting through the funeral, these sails started kind of blowing in the hot air, and it was really quite extraordinary. And as the coffin was carried out, Purcell's Dido's Lament came out, which has this amazing treble voice singing, "Remember me, remember me." And as the coffin went out, it was really one of the most spine-chilling moments. It was a great send-off, and it's an extraordinary piece of music. Again, more romantic than romantic music in a way. It's like Cathy and Heathcliff all rolled into one.
And yet all based on a simple ground bass which just goes round and round. Mm. Less is more.
Mm.
Rupert Everett, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
When I Am Laid in Earth from Dido and Aeneas, composed by Purcell and performed by Joyce DiDonato and the Il Pomodoro Orchestra, conducted by Maxim Yemelyanichov. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael's going to be talking to actress, author and crossbench peer Baroness Lola Young of Hornsey. But next on Radio 3, Sarah Moore-Peach is taking us on a musical journey with Mozart.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
He was the most important English composer of the 17th century. Henry Purcell. On Composer of the Week, we're exploring how the City of London, in which Purcell spent all of his short life, shaped his work and legacy. Composer of the Week, Henry Purcell. Starts tomorrow afternoon from 4 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
This is Radio 3, and at 3 o'clock it's Choral Evensong from Chester Cathedral. But now, time for Music Map. Your guide is Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map with me, Sarah Moore-Peach, a journey through time and space that takes us towards a single musical destination by way of sonic connections. Coming up at the end of today's show, an expression of rapturous delight and virtuosity, the solo motet Exultate Jubilate by Mozart. Yulia Lezhneva, singing the Alleluia that ends Exultate Jubilate, and we'll hear her in the full four-movement work at the end of today's show. And let's begin with another famous Hallelujah.